Spout Blog and the Webby-nominated Film Couch podcast are covering what's truly interesting in the film world every day. Find out why the New York Times says Spout Blog's got it all at blog.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Matty Robinson. This week on the show, everybody needs money. That's why they call it money. Film Spotting goes for one last big score with a countdown of our top five heist movies.
Maybe David Mamet's most confounding line of dialogue ever. Also on the show, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by Justin Townes Earl, and the fourth film in our Pedro Almodovar marathon, Talk to Her.
But first, reviews of the two heist flicks that prompted this week's top five, Flawless and The Bank Job.
The Royal Princess.
Oh, dear.
What a fiasco.
We have to get our hands on these damning photographs of a certain royal person.
The photos are in a safe deposit box at the Lloyds Bank.
There can be no connection to us.
Ah, makes us all look stupid.
I've got a proposition for you, Terry. A bank.
As in, Rob, can you see us taking on a bank?
This is about getting into the deposit box's secret wealth, because people won't report it.
Dun, 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 dun. Kempy,
yes.
You get the guards. You get the guards. I'll get the vault. It's heist week here on Film Spotting, and I think it's a little bit of trading places this week because Mainstream Maddie and Arthouse Adam actually reviewing sort of opposite films. I got to enjoy the limited release of Flawless, and you got to take in The Bank Job.
It's true. We did sort of violate our rules of engagement here on Film Spotting. Rather than talking about two films that we both saw, we're kind of splitting up the duties a little bit. That's just the way it shook out this week.
Yeah, unfortunately. I've been very busy.
Me too.
Some joints.
Mm-hmm.
Playing at the OTB. But as you know, and I think as most of our audience can imagine, I'm really sort of an ardent devotee of this genre, the heist genre. And over the years, I've noticed some trends throughout these films. So I've developed a little checklist, a little film spotting checklist that you can keep by your bedside. And I'm going to ask you, Mr. Kempinar, if The Bank Job falls in line with these questions. Was there a confident lead burglar?
More or less, yes.
Was there a more skittish sidekick?
Pretty much, yes.
Is there a hot mall?
Yes.
Does she at one point distract somebody?
I believe so.
Was there impeccable and ingenious planning?
Actually, not really.
Oh. Was there a moment when everyone is confronted with a seemingly insurmountable mountain to climb, like 40 feet of swimming pools full of leopards that can only be tamed by a rare diamond which just happens to reside in the breast pocket of Al Capone's bookkeeper?
Not really.
All right. Was there a good guy that turns out to be a bad guy?
No.
Was there a bad guy that turns out to be a good guy?
I don't think so.
Was there a chase scene?
No.
Can you recommend it to Maddie or to anyone else for that matter?
Despite all of the contrary answers there, actually, I would recommend it to you. And maybe one of the reasons why is that it violates some of the normal things we're used to with bank heist movies.
You saw where I was going.
Yeah,
you saw where I was going.
It really does. There are some things there, obviously, that the movie does that a lot of bank heist movies do, but there are some notable ways it departs from what we are used to. And I have to say that I did like this movie quite a bit, and I remember one of my film profs saying that a good opening scene a lot of times can set up the entire film, really set up the entire tone of the film, the mood, you know, the structure in terms of the way it's going to be shot. You can tell it all from the opening scene, and The Bank Job opens with an attractive woman swimming with two men in the ocean or in the sea. And if her breasts aren't the first thing we see, they're certainly the second or third. And then we get the trio heading into the bedroom where they are photographed in the act. And these photos, with their scandalous content, end up propelling the entire action of the movie The Bank Job, ultimately.
Isn't this based on sort of a real event?
Wasn't there some
sort of, you know, British monarch involved with this?
Supposedly, though, how much of that really factors into the true story and what they're embellishing here is up for debate, basically. But the movie tries to put forth this theory that there are these photos of Princess Margaret caught in this act, and that really is what pushes the whole film forward. I mean, yes, the main characters, Terry Leather, played by Jason Statham, and his guys, they think they're getting into it because it's a big score. They're going to finally make some big money. But really, the person who's kind of pulling all the strings, Saffron Burroughs, the mall in this case, she's the one who is after these photos, and we won't get into all the reasons why she's doing that. But it is a case where you've got this member of the royal family involved in this scandal. But rather than that scene being just your typical case of gratuitous movie nudity, And I would actually say that the movie, I think, does a good job throughout the film of being kind of grimy and dirty but not really reveling in it. It actually sets up the central dynamic of the film and what interested me about it, which is that idea of corruption at the highest levels, where you have a movie that's stripping back the blinds and it's showing mm-hmm. you how these supposed sophisticated people are really just as corrupted and degraded as the rest of us. And Jason Statham, even the main character, has a thing for Saffron Burroughs. They grew up in the same neighborhood, but again, it's a case where everything isn't what it seems on the surface. She's the girl who seems to be better than everyone else. She got out of the old neighborhood, but now she's back in it. She's involved in this heist, and then of course has her own motives as well, as I touched on. So it is something that I really enjoyed watching, just the movie reveling in this idea that, you know, the people at the highest level seem to be so perfect and sophisticated and everything is the way it should be. They're really just as messed up as the rest of us, and that really is kind of fun to watch. And, of course, when you get to the idea of these robbers going after these photos, it makes you think a lot of the movie Inside Man, where that really is the ultimate goal as well. Without giving anything away about that film, the key difference is that the important item that's in the vault, in the lockbox, in Inside Man is something truly reprehensible and evil. And this is just related to sex. And when you see some various critics talk about this movie being a throwback, I think that's part of it. There's something really quaint and fun about the idea that the British intelligence service is actually going to go through all this trouble just to avoid a royal scandal. I mean, it's so 1970s.
Yeah.
And that is kind of fun about the movie. And there also is the big difference, and we get back to your questions then. The big difference between this movie and a movie like Inside Man is that the people who are involved in this heist are not nearly as competent as we're used to seeing in some films, like an Inside Man, where they're in complete control all the time, really pulling all the strings. Here, the robbers are completely out of their league, and they're pretty much incompetent, and they manage to pull off the heist only in large part because of dumb luck. I mean, this is really a case where these guys are more Dog Day Afternoon than Ocean's 11. Mm-hmm. And we actually got an email from a listener, Dave Turner in Buffalo, where he commented on this, and he really nicely put it. He said, in The Bank Job, our thieves aren't professionals. Some heist movies like Ocean's 11 play the heist fast and loose, not necessarily for laughs, but certainly with a smile. But Danny Ocean's crew are clearly competent professionals. The Bank Job delivers classic heist movie pleasures without being undermined by unprofessional characters. I agree completely. That's part of the fun of this movie, is watching characters we're not used to seeing who really don't know what they're doing. Where I do disagree with something that Dave said is he made the claim in this email that it's kind of like a prequel to a later made heist movie where it's criminals made at the start of their career, that it avoids the convention of showing bank robbers. We see it all the time where they're just trying to pull off their last big score. Mm-hmm. That's where he's wrong a little bit. I mean, Terry gets involved with this heist because he, as he puts it, wants to make sense of everything. This is the score that's going to make everything go away, solve all their problems. He really is getting into it to get out of it. And that is another way, actually, that the movie, I think, is different than a lot of heist movies, though, because you've got a case where it's their first real job. They're just small-time crooks. They've never done anything like this before, so it's their first big job. It's also their last. I like Jason Statham in it. You know, there's a part near the end of the film where he basically turns into the transporter, which I haven't seen those movies, but I've seen enough previews and scenes from those movies. He basically turns into this total badass, even though his character really shouldn't be that much of a badass, and yet we completely buy it because he's the transporter. You know, and the movie's really working up until that point. I was actually thinking about Howard Hawks this week. Imagine that, as we started teaching our class at the University of Chicago. And Howard Hawks famously said that a good movie is a movie that has three great scenes and no bad ones. And I'd be hard-pressed to come up with any really great scenes, certainly mm-hmm. three great scenes in The Bank Job, but there are no bad scenes. The whole movie works. I say go see it.
For 16 years, I've been working within a hair's breadth of one of the largest single deposits of riches on Earth. And for 16 years, I've never opened it. Not once.
Quick.
Mr. Holmes.
Always the first to arrive and the last to leave. Your colleagues must value your dedication.
Things are never as simple as they seem.
I know you've been passed over six times to someone less qualified than you.
My mother said beating the boys won't make you popular or happy. Turns out she was right.
Maddie, it's your turn now at the microphone to talk about the movie Flawless, the other heist movie we're going to dive into here on the show. And really, when I first saw the trailer for this movie, the only thing that really jumped out about it was Michael Caine. You saw some of those lines of dialogue, the way he delivers them, the way only Michael Caine mm-hmm. can. And I said, you know what, despite the fact that Demi Moore maybe looks a little bit brutal in this film, I'm not sure I'm buying her British accent, the fact is Michael Caine looks like he's having a lot of fun, and if he's having fun, we probably will too. The story has Michael Caine as this nighttime janitor, the guy who, it seems, you know, really knows more than he, of course, is letting on, and he orchestrates this heist of the Diamond Corporation that he works for along with Demi Moore. Am I getting it right so far?
You're absolutely right, yeah. You know, one of the things actually where I think this film got it wrong a little bit is that Michael Caine's character is supposedly this janitor who's a lot smarter than he actually should be.
Mm-hmm.
And I never liked that. Michael Caine plays working class so well. You don't need that. We don't actually think, oh, he could have gone to Cambridge, but, you know, circumstances led him to be a janitor. Why can't he just be a clever janitor? I mean, that's Michael Caine. That's
right.
Sort of, he plays his roots really well.
He always does. You're right. But they get involved then, Demi Moore and Michael Caine,
yeah,
in this heist, and she has her own grudge against this company because it's an old boys club,
right,
and they won't let her ascend up the ladder there. It made me think, actually, just in what I've read about the film and seeing the trailer, of a great film noir like Double Indemnity, where it's about characters trying to buck the system and rise above the position they've been handed, kind of fool everybody and do something really great, something really unthinkable. Am I committing blasphemy by even mentioning Flawless in the same sentence as Double Indemnity? And if I am, does Michael Caine still make the movie worth watching?
Yes, I think it is very close to blasphemy. Well, you know, unfortunately, I have to kind of bemoan the current state of film right now. I mean, we're in March and April.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is the doldrums out there. The big studios aren't putting out anything. And so this is a nice little caper film, and so I can recommend it. Put it in your Netflix queue. If you're really, really hard up and it's, you know, up there on the big board at the multiplex, yeah, you can duck in and be entertained. But there's really nothing new about this. And yeah, it's Michael Caine. He's done this before. And I think the art direction, which I think is probably the best part, the best element of this film, brings us back to those 60s heist films, those 60s thrillers, the Ypres File, or even the original Alfie, the original Italian Job. This looks like the fun, hip 1960s. Unfortunately, it's not fun at all. There's one big twist, but we're not having any sort of fun. There's no diabolical nature to this, and it's really sort of saddled with this pseudo-feminist overtones that are sort of interjected. Demi's character is passed over constantly for promotion, and Michael Caine's character actually preys on that. He actually preys on her. He plays that up to get her to do his bidding, to be complicit in this act. And that's fine. The heist aspect of it all works pretty well. Unfortunately, there are these bookends of the film. There's the beginning where Demi Moore is shown much older in a very, very bad makeup job. And there's this young woman that's interviewing her. And this 25-year-old who's always on her cell phone, who doesn't really understand, of course, the privilege that she's allowed. The women, like what women like Demi Moore's character had to endure. And it doesn't work well at all. It is so sappy. You don't have to hand us this sort of treacly stuff. Trust the story. Trust the script. You don't have to manipulate me by hitting me over the head with sort of this empty dressing.
Mm-hmm. And that does sound like a large problem we see from time to time, obviously, in Hollywood films, and we talk about that here on the show. But I wanted to ask you, because this raises an interesting point. It makes me think about the fact, and maybe this is a future top five, whether good or bad, how many times does a bookend actually work in
a movie?
Never
works.
If you think about it, I think of two big examples.
Take the first 10 minutes off of every film, the thing's going
to
fly.
Well, and your predecessor used to make a similar comment to that, but I think about a movie like Saving Private Ryan. Those scenes at the beginning and the end, for me, largely ruin the film.
Oh, they're
started
awful.
At D-Day, right? We've talked about this on the show before. The Green Mile, not a great movie, the Frank Darabont film, the Stephen King adaptation. Start that movie with the prisoner, Michael Clark Duncan, arriving at the jail and ending where it should end, rather than giving us the beginning and the ending bookend where the characters are older. Much better film. I don't understand why they feel the need to do that, and I wonder if there really are any cases where it really does work. Of course, I didn't plan to talk about this, so I don't have any in front of me. I haven't thought about it, but it'd be something to think about. Maybe I'm sure our listeners will chime in with some that do work.
I will say that the acting across the board is really, really strong here. Demi Moore is actually very good. And the reason that her British accent isn't quite on is that she's playing an American that was educated in England. She's spot on. Michael Caine is terrific. He's having as much fun as he can with this thing. I love the old boys. You know, the sort of the lily white guys that are they're playing the ruling class that are, of course, standing in the way.
We
of
see
of
them
Demi
in
Moore.
The bank job, too.
Yeah, exactly. They're terrific. You can tell they're sort of eating this up. Lambert Wilson as the investigator really sort of falls flat. That whole subplot falls flat because no one really knows in the movie what's it supposed to mean. Is it a courtship perhaps between Demi Moore and this guy, or is he going to use her, is she going to use him? And the end result is just sort of a mishmash.
Not enough intrigue there for you, like it was maybe going for.
Okay,
well, Flawless and The Bank Job are both in theaters now. Flawless in more limited release. If you agree or disagree with our takes, email feedback at filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. I'm willing to wager that you could do a better Cockney accent than Charlie Hunnam without any preparation. Go on, try it. Your top five up-and-coming actors feedback is up next. Stay with us.
Well, since you've left, I've had no place to be. I'll spend most every day doing as I please. I got pockets full of money. Hear it jingle when I walk. It's a good life from now on.
Hi, guys. It's Nat from Dallas, Texas. I just wanted to call in, number one, to say how much I thoroughly enjoyed your reviews a couple weeks ago, the entire show that covered Funny Games and the Paranoid Park. I went to see Funny Games not long after hearing your review, and I was stunned. I will say, for anyone that has ever experienced objective filmmaking where you were there and being asked to make a decision in what's going to happen next, and or how are you going to feel in the next scene, this film, you are there, you're an active participant. I couldn't breathe for an hour and a half or however long it lasts.
Hey, Adam and Maddie, it's Sam Smith from Nashville. Hey, I just wanted to call in and say that I saw Gus Van Sant's Paranoid Park, and I really think it's the best movie I've seen in years. Beautiful, poetic film that to me reaches the level of pure cinema while still having a compelling narrative to it. Really an improvement on Van Sant's Death Trilogy, which I loved too. It's just the most emotionally and psychologically authentic film I've ever seen about high school and being a teenager, and really about memory.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar. And Maddie, a couple of great voicemails there. One from Matt in Dallas, also a big fan of Michael Haneke's Funny Games. And then Sam Smith, my buddy from Nashville, saw Gus Van Sant's Paranoid Park, called it a masterpiece.
Yeah, it's right up there. Right up there in my top five of the year.
Yeah, I know it's a cliche, and some of our listeners have talked about movie critic cliches in our message boards, so now I'm really hesitant to say this, but I told you when we got off air after our review a couple weeks ago, right now, Paranoid Park would be my favorite film of the year.
Wow.
That's how much I liked it.
Wow.
So I'm right there with Sam Smith. We're going to get into some more great listener feedback here in a minute, but let's go ahead and dive into our poll questions. Starting with our poll question from last week, we did not review the gambling movie, the MIT Blackjack movie 21. It stars Kevin Spacey. So we were curious what our listeners think about Kevin Spacey as an actor. We gave you these choices. He is an acting god, a solid actor, or a smug ham. Maddie, how did it come out?
Well, if our listening audience was casting at all in Hollywood, he would still regularly get roles, because a whopping 66% chimed in and said Kevin Spacey is a solid actor, 26% a smug ham, only 8% an acting god.
Yes.
Now, I wonder, you know, if we had done that poll, say, way back when, right after Seven, right after Usual Suspects.
Mm-hmm. American
Beauty acting god might have been creeping up a little bit further, but
Actually, around that time, I would have voted an acting god,
yeah,
and here I was.
He's had some transgressions since then.
He has, and I was very much leaning towards a smug ham, but was still giving him the benefit of the doubt, a solid actor. I know you were definitely in the smug category.
What do you think about that Bobby Darin thing?
I didn't actually see it. Wasn't interested, and his appearance in it and his performance didn't really draw me to it either.
It was really, really self-serving. That's what I thought.
Well, I'm not surprised to hear that. Let's get to this week's poll question then. And this was a poll contest, a listener contest, where we invited our listeners to send in their suggestions for a poll question this week. And we said we would feature the best one on air. It was a really tough decision, got a lot of great options. But we're going to go with this one. We thought this was a nice diversion, a little bit of a change of pace from some of our other poll questions. It comes from Thomas McKenzie in Nashville, and he writes, every film opening this week looks like garbage. Adam and Maddie should
catch up on HBO's In Treatment, watch The Last Dragon at Adam's place, find Maddie a girlfriend, review the trailers of upcoming summer flicks, or bite the bullet and watch Leatherheads. Mr. Kempinar, what do you think we should do this weekend?
Well, it's really tempting to try to find you a girlfriend. It's also tempting to maybe catch up on In Treatment, which I confess last week I was sort of into, at least the episodes featuring the girl Sophie. But honestly, I got to go with Watch the Last Dragon at Adam's Place. That would be my choice. You need to see that 1985 gem, Maddie.
All right, dude. You, me, little Holden.
Yeah.
Crack open a couple beers, you and me, not Holden. And sit back and watch it. Maybe a little in treatment afterwards.
There you go. We would need therapy afterwards, perhaps.
Are we watching this Leatherheads thing?
Maybe eventually. We might even review it next week. We will have to decide that later. We do appreciate Thomas for sending in the poll question idea, and we would appreciate your vote. Go to filmspotting.net and make your voice heard. Let's get into the feedback then, Maddie, and let's start with some thoughts on Stop Loss. This is the film from Boys Don't Cry, writer-director Kimberly Pierce, her follow-up film to Boys Don't Cry. We reviewed it last week on the show.
Now, Sky writes in. Now, Sky, I don't know if that's a name or a location. He says, I thought you were both unduly harsh on this film. Yes, many times it spun out of control for its overdone melodrama. Ultimately, though, I did understand Ryan Phillippe's character's dilemma and felt very sad at the ending. I also thought that his dual role as renegade slash dedicated soldier allowed a wide range of political spectrum for the film's viewers. So many war films are really anti-war films, thus depicting only a leftist point of view. Finally, he also writes in about Funny Games. I walked out of the German original. I don't care how you two intellectualize that film. To me, it's excrement. Sometimes you guys just come across as nerdy grad students too thick in your head. Sometimes you're over the top brilliant. That's why I stay tuned.
Well, I'm taking both of those comments as a compliment, Maddie. I don't know about you, but on Stop Loss, some interesting thoughts there. Obviously, we didn't feel the same way about the film as Sky did, and it is true that most war films are anti-war films. That's kind of the point, probably, of making them. I do think you get a little bit of a balance here in Stop Loss, which is somewhat refreshing, but ultimately, the film didn't work for us, and we're going to get to some more thoughts here from Jesse Baxter in Boston, who writes in, I completely agree that Pierce's heart was in the right place in making this film, but I had issues with it as well. It should have ended much sooner, and the home video footage didn't work, though I really liked the initial war scenes in Iraq, as you did as well, Maddie. A few friends of mine have seen it and loved it, but I think it's their college angst about the war manifesting itself more than a real appreciation for the film. It seems like this movie is being marketed toward a younger audience, though. It's even an MTV film, so I'd be curious to see how high school slash college students view the movie compared with adult audiences. At least young people are being involved in the Iraq conversation, Jesse writes.
Yeah, well, I actually, if you want to get involved in Iraq conversations, I think we touched on this a little bit last week. There are better films to point these kids to. I mean, don't sell this generation short. Sure, we don't. Yeah, we've had Sesame Street pretty much strip away our, you know, our attention span. But at the same time, go to Chicago 10. Go rent No End in Sight or Iraq in Fragments. Those are much more compelling. And my God, look, you could be sent over there. Theoretically, you could be sent over there to fight. So you have a vested interest in learning everything you can about this conflict. I don't think we need to dumb it down. And that's what I felt that this film did.
Yeah, I agree with you. And really, this is a good follow-up email here from Robert Kenilworth Lewis. We've had some of his feedback featured here on the show. And he follows up with what Jesse was saying, maybe about this generation gap with this film.
I went to see Stop Loss because I had several of my college students tell me I should. I have to admit, I agree with both of your takes on it. However, as I think about the fact that it is an MTV film, I start to think about their targeted audience. I would have to say it is not a 40-something male. The flashbacks and the flash-forwards, along with the in-your-face style of seeing the injured buddy, all seem to be geared towards both someone who has a short attention span and or someone who doesn't have a history of seeing some of those post-Vietnam-era war films. So perhaps while we perceive that the film fails to do what it set out to do, the film's target audience finds this to be a more acceptable style and form of communicating the message. Just a thought. Well, I take umbrage with that. I'm not a 40-year-old male. I'm a 24-year-old male.
Okay,
Am I not in the target audience? And again, we get this. We get this MTV stuff. I don't need it. MTV has done smarter films than this one, much more mature. I'm thinking of films like Election. They've handled this material in a much better way.
Yeah, and I do bristle at that a little bit, not to say I'm actually angry or anything. I think he makes a really good point, and it's well taken, except for the fact that I don't believe that the fact as early 30-somethings, we find ourselves being,
speak for yourself,
yes,
Mr. Kemper,
being so out of touch with this movie that we can't appreciate the style. If you listen to our review, neither of us commented too much on the style. I did bring it up near the end. It didn't work for me, but that isn't why I didn't like the film. Bad filmmaking, which we thought this was, is bad filmmaking, regardless of who your target audience is. Maybe 18 to 20-year-olds are more forgiving of this type of film because of the style. I don't know. I'm not really willing to generalize in that way. I just think a bad film is a bad film.
Well, and my big thing is, all right, fine. You've got this 18-year-old, this 20-year-old, this 22-year-old faced with having to go back and fight a war. Well, then present him with real options. What do you do? Do you stay? Do you fight? Do you run to Mexico? Do you run to Canada? I never thought that those consequences were really, really examined. What happens if he goes to Canada? What happens if he runs to Mexico? That stuff is never examined. He just sort of wallows in this imagery that keeps getting thrown at him. War is bad. What should I do?
Yeah, I mean, the movie certainly touches on those things. It presents the idea of if you go to Canada, this is kind of the way your life is going to be. But ultimately, I don't know that it examines it enough that satisfied either of us.
No, it just sort of rang really false.
Yeah, and for me, it really was more a matter of the way the soldiers were portrayed. It just got very redundant for me. So,
all right. Well, one of your soldiers, one of the soldiers in the film, was one of your top five up-and-coming actors, Mr. Channing Tatum.
Yes.
Also the star of Step Up.
Yes, and Step Up to the Streets, which I commented on. And we did get a lot of feedback about our top five last week, up-and-coming actors. And let's go ahead and start with this one from Travis Hobson in Alexandria, Virginia. You two were mentioning your favorite up-and-coming actors, and the names Melanie Diaz and Charlie Hunnam happened to come up. They were both in my top five. Melanie was good in Be Kind Rewind, but the movie she first caught my attention in was Raising Victor Vargas. It stars Victor Rasik and Judy Marte, and Melanie plays Judy's best friend, and she literally steals every scene she's in. I hope you guys check it out if you haven't already, because I'd love to hear your thoughts. Did you guys ever catch the short-lived TV series Undeclared, written by Judd Apatow and starring Seth Rogen, Jay Baruchel, and pretty much everyone who's ever been in an Apatow film? Charlie Hunnam plays the promiscuous British transfer student. It was a criminally underappreciated show that showed early on just how talented that group really was. I honestly think it was Hunnam's best work to date. He's great in every episode. And I knew, Maddie, that these were going to come up because I obviously saw in their filmographies that Melanie Diaz was in Raising Victor Vargas, a film I haven't seen, unfortunately. Sam was always a big proponent of that film. And then also Undeclared, a show, even though I'm a fan of Apatow and Seth Rogen, I never saw it when it was on TV, and I haven't had a chance yet to dive into the DVDs. So I knew that would come up, and Undeclared did come up a lot from listeners who heard our top five.
Yeah, I remember Undeclared. I actually think I was in college when it came out, and it's so hard when you set a sitcom in college. It never really finds its audience, because the fact of the matter is, when you're in college, you're basically watching Mayberry reruns during the day and, you know, at night studying or watching, you know, what, Wheel of Fortune?
You were studying a lot, Maddie.
Well, I don't remember watching TV.
No, that's true.
You know, and so, you know, I think we watched ER every Thursday night. That was the big thing. But, you know, you don't get together and you watch a sitcom about what you're experiencing.
No, that's a good point.
So, but yeah, I don't remember it being that groundbreaking.
Well,
either.
We had a lot of people who were fans of Charlie Hunnam in my pick. Certain people, like our next listener here, not a fan of the selection.
No, he says, this is Will McDermott in Dublin, Ireland. He writes, and hey guys, just listened to your top five up-and-coming actors and was horrified to hear Adam choose Charlie Hunnam. Even though you mentioned that Hooligans was a terrible film, I was stunned that you singled out Hunnam for any kind of praise. His performance in that film regularly shows up on worst movie accent lists on film forums over here. His accent was a strangled mix of fake Cockney, also known as Mockney, and a hideously over-the-top South African accent.
I'm not being funny, but the last thing I want to do is take you to the match with me. So here's how it works. Give me off the money, I'll go to football, and you can have a wander around where Churchill's at the top, or whatever it is that you Yanks do in Jolly Old.
The worst part of this whole mess is that Hunnam is actually English. I'm willing to wager that you or Maddie could do a better Cockney accent without any preparation. Come on, Adam.
No, you Adam. Do not want to hear
Come on,
it.
Adam.
I can't. I'm sorry.
All right. Well, come on, Adam. Didn't you mention once that you spent some time in London during your college years? Did you ever hear anyone speak like Hunnam over there? I doubt it.
Well, I don't know that I spent much time in London's East End, and I'm not good enough with accents to detect when an accent is good or bad, really. I mean, there are certain times certainly you can watch Prince of Thieves and tell that Kevin Costner is dropping in and out and stuff like that, but I'm not sure that I could obviously watch Hooligans and know that Charlie Hunnam was delivering a bad accent. I thought in terms of the other aspects of his performance, he was really good, but hey, maybe I'm wrong. I'm willing to entertain counter arguments there. Let's go to John Heberle in Bay Village, Ohio. His top five, Noah Segan. He played Dode in the movie Brick. Really great. Benjamin McKenzie. Yeah, the dude from the OC. He's probably actually really popular because of that show, but in film circles, maybe not so much. He was great in Junebug. Matthew Good, he was in Match Point, which I haven't seen, so this may be a little less inspired than I had initially thought, but he was also in The Lookout, which he was one of the best things in. He was pretty good in The Lookout as the bad guy there. Shane Carruth, he's only done one thing, Primer, but it was great. Maybe not so much the acting, but he did everything in that film, so you got to give him a spot, I guess. I mean, he was the writer-director, too, and maybe that was better than his acting. And finally, Ben Whishaw. I thought his brief moments in I'm Not There were some of the best of the film. I agree. I liked him as the narrator.
I agree wholeheartedly in that film. I hated Whishaw, though, in Perfume.
See, I thought he was good in Perfume.
Oh, no, I couldn't stand
it. I did. I really liked him there. But,
although he out-acts Dustin Hoffman in that film.
Well, Dustin Hoffman's brutal in Perfume, I think. And Maddie, now we got to get to someone chiding you a little bit.
Yeah, Samuel Todd Stevens of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He writes in, Maddie, I am truly disappointed in you. I was looking forward to this top five list. It sounded like an opportunity to hear about some future stars I knew nothing about. And it's always the top five list where I learn something that I enjoy the most. Unfortunately, what I learned from this list is that apparently Jeremy Renner has fooled some very intelligent people into thinking that he's an appealing actor. I was going to give you the benefit of the doubt and assume you accidentally were reading off your top five actors we wouldn't cast list, but then your praise deep-sixed that theory. Some way or another, Renner always manages to be my least favorite part of a movie. He almost single-handedly ruined 28 Weeks Later with his completely flat performance as the sniper. He also helped put the flawed in what I describe as the flawed brilliance of The Assassination of Jesse James. Watch it again and tell me he isn't completely out-acted by Paul Schneider in every single scene. The disparity is huge, but he also says, great podcast, guys, even though you're completely wrong.
I wouldn't mind going back to Jesse James for a lot of reasons and seeing that film, but also to compare maybe whether or not Paul Schneider is getting the best of him.
I think when we originally reviewed it, those scenes were actually what we loved most. And if we could have seen more of the gang, actually less of this, of the Casey Affleck relationship with Brad Pitt, which went absolutely nowhere and dragged for the better half of the second part of the film. But yeah, the gang stuff was all really good because you had a really great stable of young actors, Delahunt, Schneider, Renner.
Yep.
I thought they were all great.
No, I agree. I really like Jeremy Renner. I'm not sure where St. Stevens is getting so worked up about him. We also got a voicemail from Eve in Brooklyn who mentioned that Renner was on a show called The It Factor. This is a show about up-and-coming actors, people trying to make it, struggling, getting their first roles. I remember seeing The It Factor, the original. This was then the second one on Bravo. I believe it was Bravo, again, The It Factor LA. And she says if you're a fan of his, you should try to seek it out because you see how he goes from basically being a guy living in like a cockroach-infested apartment to a guy who we're talking about here on our show and is in movies like Jesse James. So wanted to mention that voicemail from Eve. Let's go ahead and close with this one from our friend, our new nemesis, Kevin Crossman. He says, Maddie, you were this close to being right with your number one pick, Dan Fogler. The first actor that came to my mind was Troy Gentile, who has played a young Jack Black in two movies and played a young Dan Fogler in Good Luck Chuck. He's really great in Drillbit Taylor, basically playing the same Seth Rogen role that Jonah Hill played in Superbad. He'll be a comedic superstar when he's old enough to graduate to R-rated roles. Oh, Fanboys is gonna suck. Take it to the bank.
Ouch. Ouch. You know, we got a lot of these emails, this Good Luck Chuck thing.
You didn't even see it.
What is that?
That's the movie with your boy Dane Cook in the lead role and Jessica Alba.
What? Why did anybody see that?
I don't know.
Why did anybody listening to this podcast see that
film? Dan Fogler fans out there, maybe? I don't know. We should mention, too, before we close this segment, Josh from Wilmette, he pointed out that Dan Fogler is going to be playing Alfred Hitchcock in the upcoming movie Number 13. So something to look forward to for you Dan Fogler fans out there. And as always, we appreciate all the great feedback. Wish we could get to more. If you've got any thoughts for us, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Time for another quick break. When we return, Massacre Theater, and Adam tells me how long he'd stay by my bedside if I was clinically brain dead after being gored by a bull. I'm guessing a solid 20 minutes.
If you're lucky.
Stay with us.
Well, now who am I to say? If all I know is what I heard. With the things some people say, you can never be too sure. But who cares where you find comfort? I'm no one to deny anybody what they need to take them through a night. Cause who am I to say what you should do behind closed doors?
I don't know. I guess I'm just scared.
Of what?
Duh, boys. Never even gone to first base with a guy.
Haven't you ever practiced on one of your girlfriends?
Ew, no. It's gross.
Well, it's not gross. How else do you think girls learn? Okay. Face me. Now, close your eyes and wet your lips.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. I'm Maddie, that's Adam. It's time now for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater, where Adam and I massacre a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a free beloved DVD of your choice. Now, last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard between Sarah Michelle Gellar and Selma Blair from Cruel Intentions.
The immortal Cruel Intentions.
Yeah, exactly. A couple heavyweights going at it there. A tie-in with last week's review, of course, of the new film Stop Loss, both films starring Mr. Ryan Phillippe.
Yeah, and we got this comment from Jeremy Smith in Brooklyn, Ontario, Canada. Brooklyn is my favorite borough in Ontario, Canada, by the way. He mentions that Ryan Phillippe notably met his future wife, Reese Witherspoon, on the set of Cruel Intentions, and then later this film, Stop Loss, he supposedly had a little fling with Abbie Cornish. So all these layers to the tie-ins with our Massacre Theater.
And you really could tell.
Yeah, you really could. Also, Ross in Fredericksburg, Virginia says, so I've never been so glad that Film Spotting is not a video podcast as I was when you guys were playing Sarah Michelle Gellar and Selma Blair in Cruel Intentions. What's next? The sex scenes in History of Violence, or God forbid, the scene from E2 Mama Tambien?
That sounds like a challenge to me. All right, Adam, reach into the Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Emily Guerrero from Grants Pass, Oregon. Maddie, you have no idea where that's at.
No clue. I'm going to put it out in the eastern part of Oregon, the desert. The desert part.
You have no idea landscape is like in Oregon.
I don't. Is there a desert?
I don't know. Congratulations to Emily. Email feedback@filmspotting.net. Tell us where you're from, where you're located, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
It's a scene, man. Memorize it.
What?
Look, man, an undercover cop's got to be Marlon Brando, right? To do this job, you got to be a great actor. You got to be naturalistic. You got to be naturalistic as hell.
Maddie, we move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and it does tie in with our top five this week heist movies. You started out, I'm going to give you the action, and this is going to be positively brutal on my part. I'm just saying that right now. And action.
Tell me, Celeste, what do you do for a living?
I'm a sales rep, and I came here to call on a customer, but they gave me a hard time because I'm a girl.
Is that how you think of yourself?
As a sales rep?
As a girl?
Yeah, I don't have a problem with it.
I like your hair. I like your outfit.
Actually, this is my second favorite outfit. I had a first favorite, but it got ruined, and I had to get rid of it.
You did?
It smelled.
Really? You haven't cleaned and helped?
No. So tell me, Gary, what do you do for a living?
How far do you want to go with this?
Not yet. Don't say anything yet.
I don't think it works if we're somebody else. I mean, Gary and Celeste, what do they know about anything?
And scene.
One of the best scenes very nicely
in the film. One of the best scenes in the film, now forever ruined by my performance there. If you know what film we did just absolutely destroy, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, including your name and location, by Wednesday, April 9th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit www.filmspotting.net.
Dicen que por las noches no más se le iba en puro llorar. Dicen que no comía, no más se le iba en puro tomar.
Maddie, let's spend a few minutes now on the fourth movie in our Pedro Almodovar marathon, 2002's Talk to Her. It is a film that earned Almodovar an Oscar nomination for Best Director, and it actually won Best Original Screenplay that year in 2003. And this is another movie that, like all of these films, sort of defies a plot description. But basically, you have two men, two strangers, Benigno and Marco, who are watching a dance performance together at the beginning of the film. They're seated right next to each other, though they are strangers. They then end up becoming really close friends because the women that they both love end up in comas in the same hospital. There's this young dancer, Alicia, who Benigno loves from afar, or stalks. Yeah. She's the victim of an accident. And then there is Marco's lover, Lydia, a renowned bullfighter who loses her concentration during a match and is badly gored. We discussed All About My Mother last week, and that's a film where Almodovar is clearly paying tribute to actresses and mothers everywhere, including his own mother. What the hell is Talk to Her about, and were you able to connect with it? And I do want to put a little bit of pressure on you before you answer those questions. We got an email from Sean Lane in Chicago who wrote in and said he can't wait to hear our takes on Talk to Her. It's his second favorite Pedro film after Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. Can you enlighten Sean? I'm not sure that I can this week, if I ever can.
I have no idea what it's about. I really don't. I suppose someone could sort of deconstruct it down to some catchy boilerplate language like, you know, two men who, through each other, find out how to love.
Uh-huh.
You know? But I think that's rubbish because I really feel this is one of the greatest films I've ever seen.
Seriously?
I really do.
That's great.
I really do.
And I don't want to give the impression I didn't like the film. We'll get to it in a second.
I really do.
Wow.
I don't have any desire to try and describe what it's about because I think I'd probably convince myself that it's not that good. If, you know, if I sat there and I actually started breaking down all the grander themes, all I can speak to is the cathartic release that mm-hmm. I felt at the end of this film, that sort of that purgation of the soul that Aristotle talks about. After watching this film, I really felt like my head, my stomach were just adrift, both floating down the Ganges on a balsa raft.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of my new favorite movies of all time. Put it in the pantheon.
Wow.
And it's gorgeous. It's touching. It employs the surreal with the fantastic. But the real achievement here is how we've seen Almodovar grow. It's the same fantastic Almodovar world populated with the same colorful and diverse cross-section of humanity that has never given enough screen time in mainstream America films especially. But it's a better tour through that world.
Mm-hmm.
It's riveting. He doesn't let scenes or plot lines overstay their welcome. For me, this is a near-perfect film.
Wow. I can't say that I had that same experience, but I did really like it. It is, in fact, my new favorite film in the marathon. I was a big fan of All About My Mother. This movie, again, takes you on a little bit of a different journey and goes about it in a different way. But yes, I was extremely moved by it as well. And I mentioned our listener, Sean, who really likes this film. One of his comments was, and he's dead on, of course, that this movie is less manic than his mm-hmm. other films. And we have seen that development a little bit here through these four films. They've gotten less and less melodramatic and more based on kind of coincidence and a little screwball, if
yeah.
you will. They've gotten more subdued, but still more moving.
Well, but think about what you're saying. You're saying this is actually less screwball, but think about it. It's two men grieving.
Bullfighters,
one of them's a gored matador. You know, the other is a brain-dead ballerina.
But so
that's,
lyrically.
That's exactly. It's that achievement. His mm-hmm. ability to cull emotion from that real, pure emotion, it shows you can have these sort of ridiculous soap operatic stakes, and if you play them correctly,
mm-hmm.
it's so moving.
Yeah, and all of the actors here hit all of the right
notes
as well.
Everybody's on the same page.
Yeah, they are. And this also answers the charge brought up last week during our discussion of All About My Mother, that there's really nothing sort of scandalous or subversive about it here. You've got some things that Almodovar is dealing with that again, take that to a different level. A lot of institutions are being challenged here. And I know from glancing at a few things that the mere fact that Lydia, the bullfighter, is a bullfighter, the fact that it's a woman,
mm-hmm.
That's supposedly subversive, and I can understand based on what limited knowledge I have of that culture and the bullfighting world, but I don't know nearly enough about it to really try to dissect that. Also, though, you get into where this story goes with one of the main characters. Not going to give anything away here. I want anyone who's coming to this film to experience it for themselves, but it is really hard to reconcile what our main character, a main yeah. character who I think it's very clear, Benigno in this case, it's very clear Almodovar has a lot of affection for him and wants us as an audience to have a lot of affection for him. And he ends up doing something that really forces us to question that affection.
Well, throughout the film, he's got a little Mark David Chapman in him.
Yeah.
I mean, he really is.
He does.
I mean, he is flawed. His obsession and his devotion is at once disturbing, but it's also so touching. And
I
just love that. He is not afraid to throw flawed characters because, my God, what are we on this earth if not flawed?
Mm-hmm.
But then also contrast that with the other male lead, and I don't
Marco.
Know the actor's name.
Yeah, I didn't write it down either, unfortunately.
He is just absolutely fantastic. And he's actually he was sort of my guide through this film, the
mm-hmm.
guy that I attached to the most. And he seems really, really well grounded. He seems to have everything under control. And then he's just put through the blender. And the way he wears it on his face
yeah.
as all these challenges sort of wash over him, it's just magnificent to watch.
Yeah, and it really is a film, of course, dealing with memory and characters going back and questioning certain moments in their life
mm-hmm.
or trying to visualize them and deal with them in a way. And so, of course, it jumps around in time quite a bit. It's actually three different big chapters, I think, where it's broken down by the male and female characters. We see the names on screen. There's three different couples that the movie sort of picks up with as the story goes along and jumps around in time. That's really fun and interesting to watch, I think. But, you know, for me, and you talked about the Marco character, that's where I really grabbed onto this film as well. Beyond the politics of it, whatever Almodovar may be trying to say there, I was moved by what I guess I saw potentially as the message of it, a lot like I was with All About My Mother, where the film's called Talk to Her, but honestly, it seems to me it should have been called Listen to Her. Mm-hmm. Because the key part that I'm not sure if Marco actually ever realizes, and I think this is really an interesting choice on Almodovar's part, the movie doesn't ever acknowledge whether or not Marco realizes that that key moment that leads to Lydia's injury, that puts her in a coma, he probably had a large part to do with. Again, we see it very clearly. Almodovar wants us to realize, as an audience, that he had a big role in that. And it seems that Marco is envisioning it and dealing with it in his head, but we never get that actual acknowledgement that he realizes the lesson of what he did or not.
Right, and then he's going to play with that again at the end. Just, mm-hmm. I love the way that Almodovar is disseminating information here, and I also love how he showcases the power of the arts and his sort of his melding of his own.
We've seen that throughout.
Yeah, his, but here it works even better because you've got his own appreciation for sort of avant-garde dance and film, which stems from Almodovar's own days in the 1970s, you know, Spanish cultural underground. Whereas before in those films, they were sort of a nice interlude, you know, but here they're woven into the plot and they give us a real reflection as to who these characters are and where their heart lies. When we see one character crying at this, Mike, this really sparse, you know, dance, opening dance number, mm-hmm. which is breathtakingly good. You know, there's something going on there. We're not quite what, but we know where his heart is lying. And it speaks also then to the power that this film had on me. Because, again, I can't put a finger on exactly what moved me. All I know is that I was just a waterfall by the end of it.
Well, I wasn't a waterfall, but I definitely was incredibly moved by the film. It, one of those movies that whether that was his intention or not, just like it made you sort of want to call your mother at the end of All About My Mother, made you want to go to your wife and say, I appreciate you, you know? Same thing here, where with this film, you go, man, I'm a lot like Marco, where I am pretty focused on what is going on. I'm pretty solipsistic. And the fact is, I need to be a little more open to what is going on around me, especially with the women in my life. It had that personal kind of impact on me. And so what more can you ask of a film? It really is pretty phenomenal to watch. And we have one more film in this marathon, and that movie is Bad Education. It comes up next week. We'll discuss it here on the show. And then after that, Maddie, the Almodovar Marathon concludes. As I said, we are looking actually for what should be the topic of our next marathon. We got an email today from a listener who said that they would prefer that maybe instead of single directors, we went back to genres or something like that, a little bit more sweeping maybe. We have done horror and screwball comedy
space?
And westerns.
Have we ever done space?
I don't think we have. We could do a sci-fi marathon, certainly. But basically here, we're making the pitch. We're open to suggestions. What should our next marathon be? Send us an email,
movies
feedback
about puppets?
At filmspotting.net. Remember, we have said here on the show that we are looking to go non-subtitled, a little less art house here, as we have had Bergman and Almodovar. We want to go with something non-subtitled. We will remind you, too, that when we voted on Almodovar, we gave listeners a vote there, and they chose Almodovar against two other choices, Blaxploitation and Angry Young Men. The filmmakers out of Britain like Lindsay Anderson and Tony Richardson. So those two options are still on the table. And we recently got a good one, Maddie, from someone else, remember, who said we should do something on those conspiracy flicks from the 70s.
Ooh, yeah.
Like the Parallax View, which I've seen,
of course.
I've seen
We'd have
to find some others, but I'm certain we could find six of those films that I haven't seen. That might be fun. Anyway, we look forward to your suggestions. Feedback at filmspotting.net.
Time for one last quick break. The bank is worth the risk, Adam. I need it, brother. We should stay and take it down. Our top five heist movies are up next. Stay with us.
I come home and you can't give me a smile. I don't know, maybe you think that I'm bound to you. Maybe you're a fool, but you gotta treat me better than you do, cause it's hard living, loving you.
Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD, brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips.
Maddie, there is a very obvious place to start here. coming out on DVD this Tuesday, Paul Thomas Anderson's epic There Will Be Blood with the Oscar-winning performance by Daniel Day-Lewis. Go ahead, Maddie. I'll set you up.
I thought you were going to go with Lions for Lambs.
No, I wasn't. I thought you might want to do a little milkshake for us, even though it's kind of become a cliche at this point.
I'm an oil man.
Yes.
This is my son and partner, H.W.
Nicely done. That film is out now, coming out on Tuesday on DVD. It includes a featurette and some bonus footage, but not a lot there in terms of a big DVD release. I'm sure we will get something coming out here in the near future. Also out, Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story, which really does have loads of extra features, including audio commentary, and really, if there was ever a film that needed an audio commentary, by John C. Reilly and Apatow and the director, Jake Kasdan. If you're into Walk Hard...
You know, I didn't like this film, but I'm going to rent it just because of that commentary.
Yeah, it might be a lot of fun, actually, to check that out. Also, the Robert Redford film that nobody seemed to like and nobody seemed to see, including us, that is Lions for Lambs. And then Reservation Road, another movie that we didn't see that really just looked awful to me. Joaquin Phoenix and Mark Ruffalo had a really strong cast, but just really looked a little too depressing for me to want to wade into. And then All About Eve, part of that Bette Davis Centenary Celebration Collection. Try saying that three times fast. That is out now. It is also part of a five-film collection that has that special edition of All About Eve with lots of extra features. So if you're into All About Eve, and really, I don't know who isn't, you can check that DVD out now, and you can get all the DVDs we mentioned in this segment at great prices through TLAvideo.com. Just click on the Film Spotting Movie Store link at filmspotting.net. Maddie, we're going to get into our donations here in a moment. Thank our wonderful donors, but first, we do have some winners to announce.
Right.
We had some contests last week on the show, tying in with our partnership with Spout. First, though, we did have our poll contest winner. We said Thomas McKinsey. He was the one who sent in the poll question we're using on filmspotting.net this week. Thomas in Nashville, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, to claim your prize, the new two-disc extended cut edition of Walk the Line. Congratulations, Thomas. And then we have our last dragon winners. This was the recasting contest that Spout put on. You can go over and see the winners at lastdragon.spout.com. We got some really fun entries, and I know they don't mean a lot to you, Maddie, because like a good number of our listeners, you're not familiar with this gem from 1985, but we want to announce the first place winner of the contest, Shrimpton. Fellow contestant M. Robert Turnage said Shrimpton is a genius in response to his cast. The second place winner, J. Evan Moore, who happens to own the sheet music to the original score for film, The Last Dragon.
My.
Honorable mention goes to R. L. Lewis, who remade the movie into a musical. They really were some inspired casting choices there.
Their mothers are so proud.
I'm sure they are. Shrimpton's going to get the American Apparel swag courtesy of Spout. J. Evan Moore is going to win, like Thomas McKinsey, that two-disc extended cut edition of Walk the Line on DVD. Congratulations to both our winners there and to everyone participating in the contest. And we have a new contest to announce, Maddie. We have another first-place prize we're going to give out, some of that American Apparel swag, and we also have one more copy of Walk the Line to give out. This week, you know what we're recasting, Maddie?
What?
The Princess Bride.
Oh!
Who should play the Mandy Patinkin role? Who should play the Robin Wright role? What about Cary Elwes playing that role of the Dread Pirate Roberts and Wesley? Who do you think would be good in those roles if the movie was remade?
I think Cary Elwes could still do that role.
I think he probably could pull off that role. We want to know what you think.
I think he's probably itching to do it again.
He might be. Really kind of his defining role. Go to recast.spout.com to participate in this contest. And again, we will announce the winners in a couple weeks. You have a couple weeks to get this done. The deadline is going to be April 15th to get your recasting in. So again, go to recast.spout.com, participate in this contest, and recast The Princess Bride. I really do look forward to sharing some of those casting choices here on the show.
It's time now to thank those people who found their way over to filmspotting.net and threw a couple of their hard-earned dollars our way. We really are humbled by each and every single penny that we get. Thank you so much. Carly in Marion, Iowa. Charlie in Purcellville, Virginia. Jason in Evanston, Illinois. Rory in beautiful Concord, New Hampshire. Robert in Colchester, Connecticut. And Thomas in Nashville.
Thomas in
Thank
Nashville.
Thank you, one and all.
The winner of our contest. And you know who used to drive every day 30 minutes to go to work in Marion, Iowa?
Who?
This guy.
Really?
Yeah.
Would you work at the Dairy Queen?
Yes, I did, actually.
No way.
No, I did not work at the Dairy Queen. No. Where? This is actually a career, Maddie, not some little summer job. So I didn't actually meet
Iowa
Carly,
outside
though.
Of farmer?
Yes, they do, believe it or not. We do thank all of the donations, and we have to announce one more winner here, and this should be a lot of fun. Again, our new donation process, every $10 you donate, you get that name in the hat, and at the end of the month, and now we have pulled the winner finally, you get to then, if you are chosen, pick a film that we have to discuss here on the show. Some movie you've always wanted to hear us riff on, you can force us to talk about it. And the winner of the first contest here as part of this donation process is Michael Campbell. Michael, I believe in New Hampshire. Please send us three movies that you would like to hear us discuss. We'll pick one of them and discuss it here on an upcoming episode of the show or on our website. Send us that email, feedback@filmspotting.net. Congratulations to you, and again, thank you to everyone who donated. Really appreciate it.
Right, and now we open up a new cycle, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now people can donate for every $10, get your name in the hat at the end of April. We'll pick a winner, and you get to decide what you want to hear on this very show.
You are listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie, and it's top five time here on the show. We are counting down our top five heist movies, tying in with our reviews of The Bank Job and the movie Flawless. And Maddie, I am really curious to hear your list. I'm very disappointed in my list this week, which we will get to here in a second. So maybe you can come up with some inspiration here, some really inspired picks. What's your number five, and how did you go about setting up your list?
Yeah, that's far too much pressure. Well, I have to say, I like heist films that go awry. Ocean's 11 is fun, but 12 and 13 really don't have anything for me because they're absolutely void of suspense. You know they're going to pull the plan off. You know they're going to think of absolutely everything. You're supposed to sit there and say, hey, this is fun. I get to spend time at the popular table in the lunchroom, you know, and we're supposed to have a good time with Brad and George. Well, that's fine. But that's not really what I'm looking for in a good heist film. So I like things where everything kind of goes haywire.
Sure.
Number five, Johnny 100 Pesos. This is a Chilean film. It's the most obscure on my list, I promise. It's back from 1995, and it's basically the Chilean Dog Day Afternoon. And the reason that I like it is that it's set just after the fall of Pinochet. So you've got that sort of transitional period where a fledgling, you know, capitalist society is trying to dig in its heels, and you get institutions like the mafia and the black market that step in and kind of rule for a couple years. This is set against that backdrop. You've got these young kids, and they try and rob a video store, which is actually a front for a larger operation, and it goes wrong, and then it plays out on television. And I really, really like this film.
Well, I'm really intrigued. I will have to check it out. I will just say in setting up my list that I did not include or consider any con movies, though a lot of times those are heist movies as well, obviously. So a movie like Matchstick Men, which I do like, or House of Games, the
Spanish
David Mamet
Prisoner.
Film. Spanish Prisoner, which is actually a Mamet film I don't like.
Yeah.
I didn't include those films or, again, consider them. The reason I'm disappointed in my list is because I did have huge aspirations this week, Maddie, to check out some films I've long been meaning to check out and see how they fit into my list and come up with some really, again, maybe inspired is the best way I can say it, but some really good, solid picks. Unfortunately, because of the week we had a lot of stuff going on this week, especially with our first class that really dominated a lot of our attention, I did not get to these four films that I really wanted to check out. Jean-Pierre Melville's two heist films, Le Cercle Rouge and also Bob Le Flambeur. I started Bob the Gambler, did not get to finish it. Rafifi and also The Getaway, the Ally McGraw, Steve McQueen movie. Did not get to those, so you're not going to see them on my list. I'm sorry, my list is filled with a lot of really cliched choices. The only one that maybe isn't extremely obvious is my number five. That's a movie we've talked about here on the show before. It made our top five Chicago movies list, and that is the movie Thief. From 1981, the Michael Mann film with James Caan.
Oh, that's a
as
great
Frank.
Pick. I didn't even think of Thief.
Yeah, it really is one of those films, like so many heist movies, including some that are going to come up here on my list, and the movie that inspired this list, to a large extent, The Bank Job, it's a case where you have a main character who is trying to go after that one last big score and then get out. He gets a girlfriend that's going to be his wife, and he wants to start a family, and they're going to adopt a kid, and he wants to get out of the thief game. And then everything, of course, goes kind of downhill from there. There's also a lot of Jimmy Caan, I think, in Jason Statham, Again, thinking about the movie The Bank Job, where they're both these gritty, tough guys. The difference is that Jason Statham's character, Terry, in The Bank Job isn't nearly as competent as Frank is. You just do not mess with Frank. You know that he can pull off these big jobs. He knows exactly what he's doing. But it's a really fascinating film. I do think it devolves a little bit at the end. Man gets into some shootouts.
Yeah.
Not as effective, but a really interesting film. And James Caan, one of the all-time best badasses in that movie.
Yeah, it's basically Sonny Corleone is going to steal the diamonds.
Yeah.
So, all right, great pick. Well, my number four is The Taking of Pelham 1, 2, and 3. I absolutely love this film. Robert Shaw, my God, the man is brilliant as Mr. Blue. And if the cosmos ever allowed, I would want Robert Shaw to do my eulogy. That's how much I think of him as an actor. The man just has so much gravitas.
Yeah.
And so there's these armed men, which include Hector Elizondo.
Really?
And don't you know whenever you notice Hector Elizondo walks into a picture and you're like, man, this is an Elizondo joint. Don't you feel a little bit more confident?
No.
Really?
No.
I'm always like, I'm gonna give this film 10 more minutes. Hector's got something going on here.
Nice.
So you've got these armed men. They hold up a subway car in New York, and they're demanding money as they hold it hostage. Walter Matthau is on the case. This is one of my favorite New York films of all time.
Well, for my number four, let's go ahead and cue the music here. That is from the 1946 film The Killers, one of the film noirs that was part of our noir marathon here on Film Spotting. And I believe I said at the time we discussed it that I'm not a huge fan of Ava Gardner in the movie or Burt Lancaster in terms of their performances, but Miklos Rozsa's score and Woody Burdell's cinematography are just incredible. Classic noir stuff. It has one of the most memorable opening sequences in all of film history, I think, and certainly one of the best-looking opening sequences just in terms of its use of black and white and the shadows. And then you get to the heist scene itself, which plays out in this great long take with a crane, and the crane shot follows the men as they walk into this corporation pretending to be at this plant. They pretend to be workers, and then the crane follows them up the stairs to the office where they're going to go and rob the payroll. Just great filmmaking from The Killers.
Great choice. All right, well, my number three, let's hear a clip.
You want to know what your buddy Fenster told us?
Say who?
McManus. He told us another story altogether.
Oh, is that the one about the hookup with dysentery?
Fenster always worked with McManus. He was a real tight ass, but when it came to the job, he was right on. A smart man.
What are you saying?
I say he'll flip you.
He'll what?
Flip you. Flip you for real.
Yeah, I'm shaking. Come on.
Okay.
Answer my question.
And you hit me in the back. Hello?
Well, that, of course, is from The Usual Suspects. I mean, I know it's sort of what in vogue right now to rip this film, to go back.
And, it seems to.
Yeah.
But
you watch this film. The construction of this thing is impeccable. It's just sort of a master class in technique. And we're teaching a Curtiz Hawks class right now. And I think this is a throwback almost to those sort of the style anyway. And I love it. I don't care what anybody says.
Yeah, I love it too. And my next pick is probably even more fashionable to rip on here. But my number three, it's Reservoir Dogs.
And I don't want any talk about yourself personally. That includes where you've been, your wife's name, where you might have done time, or a bank maybe you robbed in, say, Petersburg. All I want you guys to talk about, if you have to, is what you're going to do. That should do it. Here are your names. Mr. Brown. Mr. White. Mr. Blonde, Mr. Blue, Mr. Orange, Mr. Pink.
Why am I Mr. Pink?
You like movies that are about the aftermath, Maddie. This is a movie where we see almost none of the actual robbery. Really, we don't see any of the robbery at all. It's just them fleeing the scene, and it's all about the aftermath and the setup to it. And I'm sorry if it has become a cliche to like Tarantino. The fact is, I know I've probably said this on the show before, I saw Reservoir Dogs when I was 18 years old, and the reason I'm sitting here today talking to you about movies is due in large part to Reservoir Dogs. And the way Tarantino embraces cinema made me embrace cinema
exactly.
In that film. It was wondrous to me at the time. Okay, it's violent.
Yeah.
It's a guy movie. Fine. When I was 18, I responded to it in a big way, and I still respond to it in a big way. It's my number three.
Yeah, it's my number two. Hands down, I think it's Tarantino's best film. It just, there's so many iconic moments to draw from. I mean, how many times when you're walking down the street with a group of guys do you not sort of just start playing
you
in your
a
head?
Little green bag.
I also love the irreverent dialogue here. Doesn't just exist to exist. For me, it clips along at a much nicer clip than it does in Pulp Fiction or Jackie Brown or some of his later works. I love this film.
Okay, well, I guess this is where we get into the redundant portion of our top fives, because my number two is The Usual Suspects. Yeah. And this is a case where, again, one last big score. You've got Dean Keaton, played by the great Gabriel Byrne in this movie, who gets sucked into that one last big job.
All those great performances there. Mm-hmm. I mean, career-making, Benicio Del Toro. Yeah. Even the Baldwin guy is great.
He's really great.
Kevin Pollak holds
Kevin
his own.
Kevin Pollak's fantastic. You're right. I do think the much maligned now Kevin Spacey, including on this show, I think he's really great as Verbal Kent in that film. And I do think that it's possible, Maddie, and I wonder what you have to say about this. I wonder, have you gone back to check out The Usual Suspects since you saw it originally?
Yeah, you can rewatch it. Unlike, say, something like The Game, it is rewatchable because it gets back again to what I was talking about, the technique, the style. Every scene is so much fun if you watch it, how it's sort of visually composed.
I think everyone at this point knows, we won't give it away if you are somehow someone who has been living in a cave for the past 10, 12 years, but there is, of course, a huge twist at the end of The Usual Suspects. And I just remember that when I saw it, I was actually in London at the time. It was 1995. And I went and saw it by myself. Just wanted to see a movie. The poster looked cool. I went and saw it. The movie took me for a ride. You talk about the technique. Mm-hmm. I was sure I knew exactly where the movie was taking me. I knew who the bad guy was. Just like Agent Koulian, played by Chaz Palminteri, I fell for everything the movie was giving me. And so then, of course, when you get the reveal at the end, it wowed me in a way that few movies have ever since, in terms of just that experience of sitting in the theater and going, wow, that movie really got me. And I know some people don't like that. They feel like it's too manipulative. I think the whole film's about the manipulation. Mm-hmm. So if you're not into that, sure, the movie isn't going to work for you. But I do wonder, I haven't seen it since that time, would it have the same impact now? Being maybe a little bit more of an astute movie watcher now than I was then, would I be as into the technique of it, and would it still have that same effect on me? I'm not sure.
All right, well, my number one, look, I'm not going to have much to say about this film, so let's hear a clip.
Robbing a bank's a federal offense. They got me on kidnapping, armed robbery. They're going to bury me, man. I don't want to talk to somebody who's trying to calm me. Get somebody in charge here.
I am in charge.
I don't want to talk to some flunky pig trying to calm me, man.
You don't have to be calling.
What's he doing?
And will you get back
over
there?
What are you moving in there for?
Will you get back there? Huh? Get back
What's
there.
What's he doing? Look at him.
Get over there.
Go on back there, man.
Get over there. Will you?
He wants to kill me so bad he can taste it.
Oh, God, I was going to kill him.
Attica! Attica!
Will you?
Attica!
Well, they just really don't make them like that anymore. And, of course, that's Dog Day Afternoon. I love the style. Lumet, he just turns the camera on and lets it roll. I mean, that was the joy of the 70s. Think about the opening shot. It's just these long extended takes through a battered New York.
Mm-hmm.
No studio is ever going to let you put that out anymore because it's just too much dead air. Think about the performances. John Cazale is just amazing in this film. And it's interesting, in contrast to the film he made last year,
Before the Devil Knows
Your Dead. Yeah. It's interesting, the construction of those scenes. In each, you could sort of diagram each scene. It'd be really kind of slow. And then right before he's about to cut, there's a crescendo of action. It's very sort of Tarantino-esque. You can tell it's sort of his new take on the heist. I much prefer his original Dog Day Afternoon.
Yeah, and I held off on saying this because I was pretty certain you were going to get to it. This is my Dog Day Afternoon memorial list. Certainly would have been, if not my number one, my number two here on this list. So I'm glad to see it there at your number one. Really is a fantastic film. My number one, here it is, the most famous scene from the movie. Let's hear it.
You know, we're sitting here, you and I, like a couple of regular fellows. I mean, you do what you do, I do what I gotta do. And now that we've been face to face, if I'm there and I gotta put you away, I won't like it. But I'll tell you, if it's between you and some poor bastard whose wife you're gonna turn into a widow, brother, you are going down.
Your predecessor used to rip me a lot for liking this film, Maddie. I wonder if you agree with him. That, of course, is Robert De Niro and Al Pacino from the Michael Mann film. Two Michael Mann films making my top five this week.
You're not going with Heat.
A film
I absolutely love.
You must have watched it with Sam, didn't you?
Jeez. What is redeeming about that film?
I can watch it endlessly
and never
get tired of it. Watch every moment of it. That scene with those two actors in it.
You're kidding
me. The dialogue.
You're kidding me.
No, I think it's amazing. I love everything about it. I love everything about the movie Heat.
No way.
Yeah. What Michael, is there not to like?
Wait, Michael Mann's Heat? Is there another Heat that I missed?
You haven't given me anything not to like about it yet.
Oh, my God. It's one of the most boring pieces of trash I've ever seen. I hate that scene. I absolutely hate that scene because there's so much buildup and there's no payoff to it at all.
The payoff to it is in the dialogue, in the exchange between those two actors, between those two characters, right, actually,
fine,
even more than the
fine,
actors.
Fine, go ahead. That's
I knew
fine.
I was going to get ripped for
That's
it.
Fine.
There it is. I love Heat. And I don't feel bad about it. It's my number one. Honorable mentions for me, Maddie. The Killing, the Stanley Kubrick film, of course, from the 50s. The Asphalt Jungle, the John Huston movie. Inside Man and Ocean's 11, a couple movies I did consider.
Yeah, Top of the World, Ma. I pretty much left off all my Jimmy Cagney favorites. Those are our top five heist movies. Please send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net. Please tell Adam how wrong he is about Heat.
I look forward to those emails. Opening wide this weekend, Nim's Island with Jodie Foster, another horror film, I believe, The Ruins, Leatherheads, the George Clooney movie, and Shine a Light. That's the Martin Scorsese documentary on the Rolling Stones. Next week on the show, it looks like we're not going to get to an advanced screening of the new Keanu Reeves thriller Street Kings. So right now, we're thinking we may only get to a review of Leatherheads. We may also fit in a discussion of Shine a Light. Check the calendar at filmspotting.net for updates there. And Maddie, I do quickly want to note that our longtime message board moderator and volunteer Alex Nesnick has decided to step down from his duties as moderator on the boards, and I don't know how we're going to replace him. He's really been fantastic, and we will miss you. Thank you for the great work, Alex.
All right. Thanks, as always, to our listener volunteers, Angela, Frank, and Candace. Special thanks to Joe Dassault, Ron Jones, and Tori Malatia at Chicago Public Radio, and to Justin Towns Earl and Bloodshot Records for this week's music. Learn more at bloodshotrecords.com. Don't forget to check out our new Film Spotting t-shirt featuring a quote from Brick writer director Rian Johnson. Get your Force for Good in the Universe t-shirts and other Film Spotting swag at filmspottingswag.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Maddie Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips. Learn more by visiting the Film Spotting movie store at filmspotting.net.
I'm Maddie Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
Heat. Heat.
I love it. I love it.
I think we should sit down and you show me why that film is good. I don't know.
I don't think I could show you any more than you could show me why Talk to Her is good. I just love it. I just can watch it forever.
Like,
yeah, I just get into it.
All right.
I just get into it in a big way.
Well, what's wrong with obvious if they're the best? I mean, you know, every now and then you got to be like,
I know.
All right, this is the best.
I know. Last time I did that, you dogged me for picking Annie Hall.
But then we finally got it off. I don't have to listen to you extol its virtues anymore.
I know.